Foster Gone Wild is sitting in Silicon Valley today, in Sunnyvale to be more precise, on a field trip with Avi Networks. An interesting startup just came out of stealth mode, which is doing a scale-out application delivery controller. Is that sort of okay?
It's close enough, Ivan. We call it the cloud application delivery platform, but close enough.
Yeah, of course. There has to be some cloud in the marketing name. Okay, with me today are three engineers, also managers at Avi Networks. You know how that goes with the startups. So where shall we start?
Hi, this is Didi. I head up product marketing for Avi Networks.
I'm Guru. I lead up product management.
Hi, I'm Murli. I'm the engineering lead.
Great. So shall we start with what you're trying to solve and who your typical customers are?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot has changed in the data center over the last few years, and with trends like mobile and cloud, you know, a lot of customers are looking at redesigning their data center network. And we've learned a lot from some of the hyperscale vendors like Google, Facebook, Amazon, just the level of user experience that they're able to provide. Well, they have hundreds of engineers who help them build their in-house load balancer, which was analytics-driven. And in a lot of ways, the enterprise customers do not have that. So we bring the same values of the hyperscale vendors to the enterprise. What we've built is a very scalable software load balancer. The key differentiation or innovation we bring to the table is it's driven by analytics. We track real-time users, servers, networks, etc., to tie the loop and, you know, influence the application delivery decisions being taken.
In more engineering terms, if you figure out that we are getting too many requests, you can spin up additional service engines so that you can serve the additional load.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I call that the Black Friday use case, if you will. You do not have to provision upfront. No hardware or software needs to be bought upfront. But since we're tracking the real-time analytics, we can see the load coming in, and we can fire up additional capacity as needed. And what's best is we can even turn them down as the load goes away.
And as you mentioned, hardware, you are typically running in VM form factor, so you don't have to buy any hardware from you, right?
Absolutely. There's no hardware from us.
Perfect. So who are your typical customers?
So right now, we're seeing a lot of success in mid to large size enterprises. Mm-hmm. Like I said, a lot of these folks are trying to get the best practices from what some of the hyperscale vendors have done. So large financials, large retail, like I mentioned, the Black Friday use case, anybody who has a spiky, you know, demand or capacity problem, those are some of the first places where we're seeing a lot of good success.
Okay, now let's go a little bit deeper into the technical part of the story.
Sure.
So if you want to have a scale-out architecture, obviously you need data plane that can scale out. And then you need something that will control that data plane and probably need some user interface. How does that work with your product?
So at its simplest, the product consists of two components. Controller, which is logically a single controller, but in of itself scale out as well. The controller is the policy repository in the heart of the system. That's what users log into. The controller exports a REST UI, REST API, on top of which we've based a web-based UI. Once a tenant or a network admin logs into the controller and requests a particular service, the second component gets fired up, which is what we call a service engine. These are the micro load balancing or micro application analytics infrastructure components. These service engines get fired up. They are the ones that sit in the data plane and provide load balancing services between users and the applications. You could have one of these, two of these, 20 or 200 of these, depending on how much overall throughput the system needs, and also policies you might have set up which allow each tenant to get their own set of service engines in spite of the fact that they might not use the throughput.
So contrary to traditional load balancing vendors, where you have two large load balancers and you push everything through them and you configure everything on those two boxes, you can either spin up new VMs per tenant, or you can have shared VMs where multiple tenants are using the same VM if, for example, they are very low volume and you don't want to spend so much RAM for every tenant.
Yes, that you put it better than I could have. So we are, for the first time, enabling our customers to decide on a tenant-by-tenant or even application-by-application basis for the absolute most business critical applications, it's almost as if they got their own set of elastic load balancers. Whereas a whole set of dev test environments or tier three apps might get a couple of dedicated engines, all of whom are crammed onto those. It really depends on the kind of resources you want to dedicate from a network services perspective to those applications.
Okay, so this all sounds a lot like NFV, the network function virtualization. And we know that the biggest problem there is the orchestration. So how does your controller tie with the environment to orchestrate the whole thing, both toward the infrastructure as well as toward the whatever northbound API?
Right. So NFV talks largely about network function virtualization, which takes you individual functions and move those to perhaps standard x86. The next transition of that we were at the forefront was how do you convert NFV into an SV, where it's a network service, an entire service that is virtualized. So we are coordinating the function. So that's the first kind of coordination we're doing. We do full lifecycle management of individual service engines that we spin up or down in real time based on overall network need or overall number of applications or tenants that are coming into the environment. So that's southbound from the controller, our ability to do lifecycle management of individual functions, individual service engines.
So that means that you are talking with someone like vCenter, and you ask vCenter to spin up a new VM for you.
Yes, absolutely. And that brings me to sort of the northbound or peer relationships with virtual machine management systems. So when we need to spin up more capacity, the system will automatically log into vCenter, spin up a new VM, get connectivity to the right networks, and make sure that traffic is flowing through. We can do a similar sort of an exercise with OpenStack by logging into Nova and Neutron components. We can log into AWS and log up and fire up additional VMs there for applications that are residing in AWS, and that's where you want to offer the service. And then the one additional thing we can do, in addition to managing our own components, is from these external entities, we can even take triggers to do automatic load balancer provisioning. So an example of this would be OpenStack, where you might go into the OpenStack UI itself, configure your application, go into the same Horizon UI, and request a load balancing resource, and we'll take that trigger through a plugin that we've written, and it comes to our controller, and then we go back to Nova and Neutron to get access to the right components, spin up the right components, get access to the right networks. So this is truly full cycle automation, where we'll take the trigger and do everything that is required southbound to spin up additional, to scale the platform to be able to provide that service in real time.
Oh, and when you're saying you take the trigger from the customer, you spin up the VM, it's not just one VM per customer, right? It could be hundreds of service VMs per customer if needed.
Yes, absolutely. So we offer a very robust policy-based framework where you can divide tenants into tenant types, and by tenant type, they can be restricted to a certain number of service engines, a certain type, one core, two core, four core, eight core, a certain type of service engine, or a certain set of services. So there's enough flexibility in the system for you to say if Coke comes in, they get their own set of service engines, but they can only do 10 service engines. And then if Pepsi comes in, they don't get any of Coke's service engines, they get their own set of service engines, but they can do 50 of them, and they can do all of these advanced SSL or application acceleration or analytics functionality as well. So there is, these policies are can be drafted on a per tenant per application basis in the system.
Okay, now that you mentioned all these services, these are obviously the data plane functions. So what can your data plane do?
So we have a very robust set of functions divided across two big buckets. The first one is application delivery. That, as you know, consists of load balancing in its most basic foundational layer. And then in addition to that, application security that takes into account SSL termination, DDoS detection and mitigation, layer 7 rules by URL for access, for redirection, and so on. And then application acceleration is sort of the third leg of application delivery, which is network-level acceleration, that is multiplexing connections, CSP connections, and so on, to application-level acceleration, which is compression, caching, front-end optimization techniques like JavaScript inlining, style sheet inlining for mobile devices, image resizing, and so on. So application acceleration, application security, and load balancing as one bucket. The second bucket is because we have this distributed platform, imagine us as having hundreds and hundreds of eyes inside your network, which are constantly tracking what's going on. So we take all of that telemetry data and we pull that back into the system. So the second bucket for us is the real-time application analytics bucket. And in that bucket, we track application response times, application behavior. We also track end-user experience down to where is Ivan right now. He's in Silicon Valley. He's accessing the website on the application on a phone. He's running this type of a browser on the phone. His total latency was X, and his page load times are Y, and is this overall a good experience or bad? So considerable amount of real-time inline analytics which compose that second bucket.
And by the way, and we'll include that with show notes, they have shown me a great screen where they analyze the response time between the components. So it's the response time from client to load balancer, from load balancer to server, and then there's the application response time, and finally the data transfer time. And of course, the picture they showed me had a few milliseconds between client and the load balancer, a few milliseconds between the load balancer and the server, and the typical 200 milliseconds for a PHP script to be compiled and executed. So this is a great tool to reduce the mean time to innocence when someone starts claiming that the network is the bad guy, right?
That is so true, Ivan, and we've had so much fun with this because we've gone within minutes from introducing the platform to people wanting to bring it into their environment and use it for what we call the flashlight use case, where they want to shine it on an application and show the application guys from a network perspective that, hey, it's not my problem. It's your application that responds 200 milliseconds one day and 3 seconds the next. So let's go ahead and fix that. So you're absolutely right. I love that terminology, mean time to innocence, from a network perspective, and it has helped reduce triage time significantly.
Okay, and now let's go deeper down into the details of the service engine. From what I understood, you told me it's more or less a full-blown HTTP proxy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Which means that probably you're doing a complete termination of one TCP session and you're opening a different TCP session to the server, which means that you have to do source net, sort of.
So with most HTTP applications, this is not an issue because in HTTP header, we put the client IP address as XLF header. So any application which no one wants to know who the client is gets the information there.
And since you are sitting on layer 7, then you can intercept all HTTP requests and do whatever data munging you want to do.
It's because we really have an IP address owned by a system. All traffic is going to come to us directly. And we terminate TCP. The advantage we have with that is because we know what the client latencies are, based on the client latencies, we can do different levels of TCP optimizations for high latency link, high bandwidth links, low bandwidth links, all those things. And between the ADC and the backend server is typically the same data center. We do different kind of optimizations there.
And you can, for example, do pipelining toward the client, and then you share the connection toward the server over multiple clients so that you don't run out of TCP sessions on an Apache server, for
Completely.
Example.
Apache is one of the biggest cases where you open more TCP connections, Apache goes really slow. So we have hundreds of connections in the front end. You can define, saying 10, 50 connections in the back end, and we multiplex on the same connections.
And then you mentioned that you do all sorts of data compression. Well, obviously, that's great for the people who can't read the manual and turn on gzip compression on the Apache web server. Is there anything else you're doing?
So the many things that we do today that's very useful for customers, one is we use caching. So instead of enabling caching on all the backend servers, which will increase the memory you need, we can cache it in the data plane for a single application. The other thing we do is front-end optimization. We can, especially if your application is slightly older and you have most of your accesses coming through mobile devices, we can do image resizing based on your device type. We can do all kinds of reduction of data for CSS and JavaScript reduction of data. And we also obviously can do compression. Other thing that we're doing today is speedy proxy. So most applications don't know speedy ever today, whereas Chrome and Firefox are support speedy, and very soon HTTP 2.0, nearly every browser will support speedy. So with that, we claim the application is speedy aware, so we get the speedy requests, and we go to the backend with 1.1. So we can get much higher performance by making the request go to different application instances and provide much better user experience.
So effectively, you are like next generation Varnish or Squid.
Exactly.
One other interesting problem that we always have when considering load balancers. It's pretty easy to do a scale-out architecture if you have many small instances, because you just randomly assign the outside IP addresses of these small instances to however many VMs you have. And then as the load grows, you just reassign the IP addresses to different instances, all is good. But what happens when the load on one IP address overloads one VM? Can you go beyond one IP address for one VM? Can you have one IP address on three or four, or I don't know how many VMs?
So we call this a secured architecture, where for a single IP address, which is for a single application, initially we start off with one VM, one service engine, and as the capacity of service engine goes to a high watermark, we can automatically create two, three, four service engines for a single application. So the way we do that is we have a single IP address across all the four service engines, but only one of them does the ARC for that. So traffic comes into the first one. The first one does an L2 load balancing of the flows across the other service engines. And those independent service engines do complete termination of TCP, do SSL termination, HTTP proxy, and the reverse traffic goes directly back from them. So the first one, which is doing the L2 distribution, is only spending about 5-10% of its time doing it across for all this traffic. So with that, we get a much higher elastic scale for a single application.
So let's say the primary load balancing service engine does both layer 7 as well as layer 4 load balancing.
Yes.
And all the other service engines do just layer 7 load balancing.
Layer 7, they go directly back.
Yeah. And because you're using SourceNet, because you're a full-blown proxy, the return traffic always goes through the same service engine, so there is no problem of asymmetrical traffic. And the return traffic doesn't have to go through the primary engine, because who cares what the source IP address is? No one is doing RPF checks anyway.
Yes, perfect example.
How many VMs could you have in this setup? I mean, what is a reasonable number? How far could you reasonably go?
Technically, we can. It's designed to go.
Well, technically, it's infinite. I understand that.
What we have tested today is 4.
Okay.
And we haven't tested higher than that. We believe there's no reason why it can't go than that, mm-hmm. but we tested 4 already.
Yeah, and it's not exactly linear, right?
It's not.
Yeah. Now, what's the throughput of a service engine?
So that depends on how many cores you give to service engine. What we have measured today is if you take a Sandy Bridge equivalent or Ivy Bridge, a 2.6 gigahertz core, a single core can do about client traffic about 4 gig, which is the service engine point of view, 8 gig of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And with SSL, we get 1 gig of bulk crypto at AES-256 in a single core.
Perfect forward sequence.
With PFS, completely enabled. And the biggest concern that people typically have is SSL handshakes, which is T-Exchange.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays, people should be using EC certificates with provides you PFS with that. With that, you get 2,000 handshakes per second per core.
So it's 2,000 handshakes per second per core.
Per core.
1 gig of encrypted traffic per core and 4 gig of throughput per core.
Per core. Right.
Or 8 gig in marketing fees.
In marketing.
These are impressive numbers. So do you get that by having your own TCP stack? Or is it just based on TCP offload?
No, our own TCP stack.
Your own or DPDK?
In some environments, we use DPDK.
Mm-hmm.
In some environments, we don't use DPDK. Because DPDK doesn't give you any benefit.
Yeah, well, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. But all DPDK does for us is enables us to bypass the kernel to give the packets directly to user space. But we have our own TCP/IP stack on top of that that does much more optimal performance compared to the standard TCP/IP stack we get to Linux.
Perfect. Now, is this performance on physical NICs or is this performance through, let's say, VMware port groups?
The performance is through VMware port groups. So this is on an ESX hypervisor.
So you get 4 gigs through a core without using SRIOP, for example?
No SRIOP in this case.
You're just using VXNet 3 drivers.
VXNet 3 driver.
That's it. What if, have you measured how much you get if you write on top of an overlay virtual network like VXLAN?
So we're agnostic to that.
I know
that
you are.
That depends on what
the performance
happens.
Suffers.
Yes, we haven't tested that.
Mm-hmm. So the moral of the story, you want high performance, use VLANs.
I think nowadays with VXLAN, depending on the, how it's implemented, it is pretty good. And it's only getting better.
Yeah, it's getting better, but we're still not there.
Yes, but what's also happening is there is DPDK being implemented in the hypervisor now.
Mm-hmm.
That should come out in the next 6 months, where there's a DPDK from the physical NIC to the virtual switch to the VM's NIC. So with that, you should be able to get pretty good performance.
Sure. Now, this all sounds great. How do I buy this?
So at the end of the day, it's software.
Well, I still have to buy it. For you, it's free. We give it to you for free.
You do have to buy it. So we keep the same level of sort of disruption quotient in some sense that's on the technology side that applies on the business side as well. As we did customer interviews, it was clear that guessing the overall throughput, doing capacity planning was big issue in most environments. So we keep it absolutely simple. We charge proportional to the overall applications that we are sitting in front of, or more technically, the application nodes or the pool members that we sit in front of. So in a very simple example, if you're using us in front of 2 applications, which are served by 4 VMs each, and we are load balancing to those 4 plus 4, 8 VMs, then that's an 8 node license that you would buy from Avi. That covers any amount of throughput, any amount of SSL connections going through the system. So no caps on throughput, no caps on the number of service engines that you spin up from Avi's perspective. So you don't have to worry about tenancy or overall how many applications you have to compress into single engines and so on. So very simple pricing model with breaks for obviously volume and terms. This is today available both in a subscription pricing model as well as a perpetual sale.
So subscription pricing is X dollars per VM
per
unit of time, yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
Perpetual is I buy it, I double quotes own it.
That's right.
Well, I use it indefinitely.
That's right.
Yeah. Can I get a deal based on bandwidth?
Yes, absolutely. So we are, if you look at the current load balancing environment, all of us, we make a choice. We say, I probably need a 10 gig load balancer. Then I purchase 2 of them and I need to make sure it can support a certain number of SSL connections and so on. We have a similar model built in as well. So if you'd like to keep things from an accounting perspective or from a purchasing perspective, similar to how you do things today, and you're buying a 10 gig load balancer, technically you actually are buying 2 10 gig load balancers for high availability. With us, because HA is built in, you would only buy a 10 gig license. In fact, I'll go a step further. Technically, when you need about 2 or 3 gig, you end up purchasing 10 gig. Just in case, and then you buy 2. So for every 2 gig you need in your data center, you actually purchase 20. And with Avi, you would purchase just 2 gig of overall throughput and match it closely to what you need.
Now for the Black Friday use case, how strict are you on licensing? So if I buy 2 gig and all of a sudden the clients are coming in.
Yeah.
What happens?
So we're actually very generous. We don't implement any caps on the license throughput. We do record it, as you might expect us to. And today it's an honor system where we request our customers to come back and purchase the or pay for that small interim period for that Black Friday use case. So a typical retailer, for instance, could buy 2 gig of aggregate throughput through the system. But for the months of November and December, you might come back and say, please give me the ability to burst up to 4 gig or 6 gig or 10 gig. Even without having that in place, the system will scale out. But we do request, obviously, that you come back and...
So I could buy a 2 gig license, and then Black Friday happens and I burst to 10 gig. And by the end of December, I come to you saying, hey guys, I miscalculated. Could you please invoice me for 10 gig in November?
Yes, absolutely. And again, here, there is no reason for Avi to implement the same price as the same sort of controls that a hardware appliance limits you to. There's no hardware appliance here. So if in the middle of the night you need additional capacity, you need to bring in two more applications online or you want high throughput, please go ahead and use the system for that. Our existing customers find that incredibly useful.
Yeah, it is. On the other hand, can I still have some hard cap? Because if I get a denial of service attack, I don't want to burst to 10 gig.
Yes, absolutely. So within the system, you might need hard cap for two reasons. One is for denial of service reasons, for instance, although I would argue it's probably better to let us scale out than have that traffic. You're right. So that use case is a great use case. The second use case sometimes that happens is people don't want to be charged. They might have budgeted for the entire year a certain amount, and they don't like this idea that if they pay for 2 gig, they have to come back and owe us some additional money. And for them, of course, you can always turn off the scaling beyond the license limits. The DDoS use case you outlined is not just from a licensing perspective, but all the way down to individual applications. You can actually limit them to certain throughputs as well if you want to have better, finer granularity control over who's using what.
So for individual virtual IP, I could say this virtual IP could consume this much bandwidth.
Yes.
You have complete controls of bandwidth and number of connections.
Which is perfect if I'm a cloud provider.
Yes.
And I offer different service levels for my customers.
Right.
Cool.
Thank you.
Have I missed anything?
I think we've covered a lot of the load balancing as a service details. The one additional thing we haven't focused on in a big way is the analytics and the real-time inline analytics capability of the platform. And we've talked about it briefly around how our ability to do telemetry is useful for feeding into the data plane for it to scale out. But I think it's useful to point out, as we get into the cloud, there's a certain class of monitoring that is not available to us anymore. We can't go up to the networking team and say, please turn on the span port so I can take this traffic and I can send it to XYZ. You don't have that option. The only option you have is inline analytics. That can be done only in one or two ways, either by putting agents inside your application, which might or might not be possible, or by using the inline analytics capability that products like Avi has built. And so there's a significant set of use cases we're seeing in the marketplace now where they're not even using this necessarily for load balancing, but in front of a single application where they just want real-time insights into what's going on with the application, or just to secure the application with next-generation encryption technologies, rather than technologies like SSL. So, for instance, we have an initiative called SSL Everywhere, and we ask a very simple question. We walk into a financial services institution, we ask them a question, Google encrypts all of their traffic, do you? And the answer, as you might imagine, is no, for cost and complexity reasons. But the reality remains, if you are efficient and you use technologies like Murli talked about, with perfect forward secrecy and elliptic key cryptography, you can actually do encryption for cents on the dollar for a very large cross-section of your traffic. So now that certainly gets interest in healthcare and financial services, and we're having a lot of success with this ability of customers to go in and say, so SSL is not just for a few critical applications that are customer visible. I can actually use it more broadly. So that's becoming a very interesting use case for us.
Okay, so I have to admit I'm not a security guy. So I might know what perfect forward secrecy is. I have no clue why it's so relevant in the... it's no longer SSL, it's DLS, right?
It's DLS.
Okay, so... Go on, explain to us why it's so important.
So if you don't use PFS, somebody could record all your SSL traffic and they'll keep it in some storage and leave it there. Someday they have your key, they can get your key, they can replay all your old traffic and decrypt the whole thing. With PFS, we negotiate a key for every transaction. And so even if you keep the whole data, because the key is dynamically generated for every new handshake, there is no way to replay that. So your data is always secure.
when you talk about the key, is it the session key between the client and the SSL termination point?
Yes, this is the session key between the client.
So the encryption key.
Encryption key.
So you're effectively generating new encryption key every time the client connects to you.
Yes. And if you use electric curve cryptography certificates, it comes part of that. If you use RSA, the default PFS is not enabled. So you have to take RSA and enable PFS specifically to that. And especially if you use most of the hardware balancers, that is very hard to do in existing offload engines. So they end up doing it in software.
Yeah, RSA is a big problem. It's CPU intensive.
And the funny thing is, electric cryptography, it is more secure and faster. Faster, and most mobile devices, most mobile providers want you to move to EC certificates because it's better for the mobile device.
It's better for the batteries.
Better.
So what you're doing is, if I have an old application sitting somewhere and it's written in COBOL and it's running on some enterprisey web server that was last updated in year 1998, you can interface with that thing and you present the modern set of crypto protocols to the mobile devices, and that COBOL application can live there forever.
Completely true.
Nice. Okay, if someone wants to know more, where can they find you?
So, would encourage folks to come to our webpage. It's avinetworks.com. That's one word, avinetworks.com.
If I want to test drive your products, can I do that?
Absolutely. So, right on our webpage is a big bright orange button which says Try Avi, which gives you access to some sandbox environments that we have made available. And also, there is a trial license button that you can click on, and somebody from our sales team will be in touch with you immediately.
So I can, in theory, get a trial license to use in my network.
Yes, absolutely.
But I have to survive the interview with your sales team.
we can make that over email.
there is a free version of the product, but it does, as you might expect, limit you to a certain scale. I would recommend our sales team. They're very pleasant. They won't take more than 15 or 20 minutes of your time. I would recommend getting a trial license.
Okay, so the free version does what?
It does all of our functionality, both the application delivery as well as the application analytics portion, for up to 2 backend VMs. So you can quickly test it out whether you're interested in the analytics portion or the application delivery portion. You can test it out against an existing application you have. And at that point, if you decide instead of 2, I need 10, 20, 100 VMs that I want to put this in front of, or applications that I want to put this in front of, please give us a call and we'll generate a trial license for you.
So I can download the free version.
Yes.
I can deploy it. I can validate that it has all the functionality that I need.
Yes.
And then as I go into a proof of concept trial, I contact your sales team. I get a trial license for the number of nodes that I need. I do the stress testing, and then I say, yes, this is for me, or, well, sorry, guys.
Yep.
Right. Absolutely. And then even if you do not want to talk to our sales folks, for instance, the complete look and feel of the product, like I said, there's a button called Try Avi. It gives you a very good overview of the entire product, all the analytics that we have, which is available from our website.
So if you're interested in UI Kitsch, you go to the sandbox. You can see all the nice glitzy graphs.
Yep.
And you want to test the whole thing in your network, then you download the free version and go from there.
Based on this conversation, I'm going to change that button to the Try Avi to here is your path to meantime to innocence.
Okay. If someone wants to get in contact with you guys, how can they reach you?
Again, the details are available on our webpage. There's a contact us button, and depending on the query, we'll be routed to the right person.
You guys have a blog, Twitter account?
Absolutely. So we have our Twitter handle is Avi Networks, and please follow us there. We also have blogs that are available from our webpage. So yeah, multiple ways of following us.
Perfect. So, thank you for this short introduction to a pretty interesting cloud application delivery platform.
Cloud ADP.
Software-defined cloud application delivery platform. And you've been listening to Software Gone Wild, a podcast on ipspace.net. And if you want to know more about SDN, go to the ipspace.net/SDN, where you'll find all the SDN-related resources, from blog posts to webinars, books, and interviews with interesting companies like this. I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and you can follow me on Twitter at IOSHints, and I blog regularly on blog.ipspace.net. And finally, if you like the podcast, go to podcast.ipspace.net and subscribe so you'll get the new episodes automatically into your RSS reader or podcast player or what have you.